Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, Scott Horton Show. Check out the website, scotthorton.org. More than 4,000 interviews now going back to 2003, scotthorton.org. Sign up for the podcast feed there and follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Introducing James Carden. He is a regular writer for consortiumnews.com and The Nation magazine, and he's the editor of the website for the American Committee for East-West Accord. And he previously served as an advisor on Russia to the Special Representative for Global Intergovernmental Affairs at the U.S. State Department. Welcome back to the show, James. How are you, sir?
Thanks a lot. That's quite a mouthful.
Yeah, that's a lot. Well, I'm glad you're here so I can cite you. Guess what? I might not have ever left Austin, but I know this guy Carden, and he knows what he's talking about.
Well, maybe. We'll see.
All right. So, man, you got this great article here. No doubt about that. Neocon scheme for more regime change. This is some of the lower downs in the State Department and their dissent channel letter that they leaked demanding that Obama launch some airstrikes against Bashar al-Assad. So lots to go over here. But I guess, well, first of all, do you know it was the neocons behind that thing?
Well, it's a neocon position, so perhaps it was uncharitable of me to describe all 51 as neocons, but that is certainly the preferred policy position.
They haven't published the names of the actual signers, correct?
As far as I know, no. Actually, yeah. They shouldn't have published the cable at all. That's the dissent channel is meant to be. Private. It's not meant to be leaked, and I can only wonder at why they wanted to do so. The most uncharitable spin, I guess, you could put on it is that it's an election year, and they darn well know that Hillary Clinton's preferred position on Syria resembles their own. And in fact, she's repeatedly called for a no-fly zone over Syria, as though that would be something easy to accomplish. When in point of fact, much like the position of the 51 dissidents, a no-fly zone over Syria would require the United States to disable Assad's anti-aircraft capabilities, and Russia's, since Russia has S-400. Anti-aircraft missiles in the area, which cover, I think, almost the entirety of Syria's airspace. So both policies are what they have in common is that they're both wondrously reckless.
Yeah. Well, okay, so it's my fault, James, that I just... It's, yeah, I don't know. It's a geographical thing, I guess. I know it's a one world, kind of an imperial system here that we're working on, and yet I keep breaking it into pieces. Well, why are we messing around with Syria? As Obama told Jeffrey Goldberg, it's to weaken Iran, kind of a consolation prize after giving them half of Iraq. Well, at least we can take out their guy Assad, in Syria. But, Iran is really just Russia Jr. The only reason we really don't like Iran is because they're a big key in Russia's imperial system, such as what's left of it, in the Middle East. And isn't that a big part of what's going on here that I usually ignore just because Russia's in a different region and I sort of keep my focus zoomed in too tight?
Well, you sound like a good realist because you still... you believe that nation states, it seems anyway, are the principal actors on the on the international stage, and I would tend to agree with you. I would add one other consideration as to why Assad has become the enemy du jour. Of course, Vladimir Putin is the other enemy du jour, but you look at Syria and you look at Assad, and Assad was actually very cooperative under the George W. Bush administration. Now, he was cooperative in doing some pretty bad things for us. He hosted black sites and the like, but he also provided intelligence and, for the most part, cooperated with the United States. He's a secular leader of a multi-ethnic, multi-religious country. And suddenly we have come to believe that we should be overthrowing a secular leader. And we've seen what happens when we do that, right? We saw what happened when we replaced Gaddafi, who no doubt was a very evil person. But what replaced Gaddafi was actually far worse. ISIS is in the process of taking over the entirety of Libya. And now, because we have been attempting to overthrow Assad, along with the so-called moderate rebels, who are nothing more than Islamic extremists, ISIS took over large parts of the country, and the opposition, as I said, is mostly al-Qaeda, al-Nusra affiliated. I wonder why Assad all of a sudden became an enemy. And what you hear is, well, he's connected to Iran, and Iran funds Hezbollah, and Hezbollah poses a threat to Israel. Well, okay. Hezbollah is a problem for Israel, but Hezbollah doesn't have designs on the United States. So I think that a lot of the emphasis on Assad has to do with the Iran-Hezbollah connection. But since I have this quaint notion that American foreign policy should forward American interests, I'm not sure why the fact that Hezbollah causes some problems for Israel, that the United States should somehow be responsible for overthrowing Assad.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Robert Kennedy Jr. Wrote a big piece for Politico back a couple of months ago, said it's all about the pipelines. And I think by the time you get to the end of the article, there's no denying he's, one, onto something, and two, way oversimplifying. And his conclusion kind of falls apart at the end, actually, because he doesn't know quite how to glue it all together, to borrow a phrase from Jeffrey Pyatt in his coup plot there. Because, you know, he doesn't actually have the statements of the major players saying it's because of the pipeline, this is why we're doing what we're doing. But on the other hand, he sure did seem to have a lot of circumstantial evidence that we have a couple of competing plans for basically one Shiite plan and one Sunni plan, one Iranian plan, one Saudi plan for how to pump fuel through Syria to Europe or to port in the Mediterranean. So how much stock do you put in that stuff?
I thought it was an interesting piece. I wasn't surprised by his focus on oil, given his career occupation and preoccupation has been as a very vocal environmentalist. But he's right in picking up. There's another threat here, and that's the Saudi threat, right? And that's, we have a clash between Sunni and Shia. And what we have a habit of doing, again, this is why we feel compelled to act this way is somewhat beyond me, but we feel compelled to further Sunni interests, right? So we've been acting as a proxy to Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey, who are all, they're all Sunni theocracies, and they all desire to be rid of Assad because he's not part of that tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Kennedy was certainly onto something.
Well, you know, it seems like a lot of this has to do with kind of making it up to Saudi for getting rid of Saddam and empowering the Iranians, right? That's the quote from, was it Prince Bandar, Prince Turkey, who said we're sick and tired of the Shia and their day's coming soon. He told that to Richard Dearlove in Britain.
That,
and over the Iran deal, too, right? We invaded Iraq and knocked off the Baathists, which empowered the Iranians and their sock puppets. Then we're doing the nuclear deal with Iran, which, you know, on the face of it, really helps protect Saudi Arabia by limiting and securing Iran's nuclear program much more than before. But it frightens them that they're maybe losing their position in our imperial system in the region if we're, you know, beginning to cozy up to their enemy across the Gulf there. And so, and just like the bombing with the war in Yemen, they even said in the New York Times, this is kind of a sop to the Saudis for pursuing the nuclear deal with Iran. And same kind of thing in Syria. As Obama explained to Goldberg, that's right, Jeffrey Goldberg. We're trying to make it up to Israel a little bit here, and by taking care of one of Iran, you know, their worst ally of Iran on their border, while we pursue this other tack on the nuclear deal.
Yeah, I mean, they all share a very strange premise, right? We need to make it up to Israel. We need to make it up to Saudi Arabia. We don't need to do any of that. The sole responsibility of American foreign policymakers is to this country and to this country's interests. When we sort of stray from that, we find ourselves in a world of trouble. Let's go back to Saudi Arabia for a second. I really don't understand why we continue to do their bidding. I thought there was a very convincing 60 Minutes report a couple of months ago that indicated that there were Saudi officials involved in the setup and in the planning and possibly in the execution of September 11th. We have become, over the past decade, an energy superpower. I do not understand how Saudi Arabia continues to have this grip over American foreign policy, except that perhaps old habits die hard. But I can't see any benefit to our country by continuing to do the bidding of these odious regimes. We've made a sort of a cottage industry of vilifying the Russian president over the past decade or more. But what goes on in Turkey and in Saudi Arabia and Qatar is far worse than anything that goes on inside of Russia and anything that's been done by Putin.
Mm. Well, yeah, it's definitely not the national interest. It's narrower interests, right? Particularly weapons sales. That's billions of petrodollars recycled right there. And even though we don't buy that much oil from Saudi, really, it's what, 5 or 7% of American oil imports or something come from there, but they spend a lot of that money on American government debt and, connected corporations, weapon systems, and this kind of thing. So that's a little iron triangle system right there. Whereas, you know, does the average Joe need any of this in order to guarantee that he can pump gas so he can get to work in the morning? No, of course not. And they would love us to believe that, you know, that all this empire is necessary for us to be able to drive our cars. But that's not true. It's just particular vested interests here and there. Certainly Houston, Texas, some parts of it have some very vested interests in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, in a sense, it makes sense from their point of view, at least in terms of Saudi itself, that America's government's role there provides stability for their business interests.
I'm glad that you mentioned weapons. I don't know if you saw the report in the New York Times over the weekend. I think it's very instructive and actually goes back
to... I was going to bring it up in a minute, but I'm glad you did. It's called CIA Arms for Syrian Rebels, Supply Black Market, officials say. Mark Mazzetti and Ali Younis.
Yeah. I mean, what an extraordinary piece, right? So only a week after the... Or maybe it was, I don't know, only a week to 10 days after the... that dissent cable by the brave 51 souls who want to put young American men and women into harm's way over the skies of Syria. After they leak their cable, this report comes out, and I'll read it. I'll read the first line to readers who maybe haven't seen it. Weapons shipped into Jordan by the CIA and Saudi Arabia, intended for Syrian rebels have been systematically stolen by Jordanian intelligence operatives and sold to arms merchants on the black market, according to American and Jordanian officials. Well, what better proof that the American policy of arming the so-called moderate Syrian rebels has failed than this report? I mean, it's really quite extraordinary. And then it's still worse. The reason American officials have got onto this scheme is because some of the weapons that were stolen were then turned around and used by a Islamic radical to shoot down two Americans at a police training facility in Jordan. So the FBI got on while investigating that. Got onto this, weapons smuggling scheme. Yeah. It's really quite extraordinary, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. We need a good catchphrase for the name of this scandal. It's just another gun walking thing. It's exactly like what happened in Arizona and Mexico there, where they're arming up their enemies and then they're surprised when they get shot by them. Little Benghazi, same kind of thing there too.
Someone said over the weekend, I think it was on Twitter or something, that Hillary Clinton is very concerned about weapons and gun sales in the United States because they cause more violence and crime and killings, but that doesn't apply overseas. her thing is like, no, more weapons funneled into all these countries is going to solve the problem, but that doesn't apply in the United States, where mm-hmm. we have to shut down gun sales and all that. It's not exactly a consistent position.
Well, and I hope I'm not going too far into confirmation bias here, James, but it seems pretty clear to me that the American government party line all along has been, at least the Obama line, that, well, let's back the moderates a little bit if we don't go as far as Hillary and Petraeus and the others want us to all along. And so when the New York Times writes an article like this, or even going back to David Sanger's piece back in 2012 that said, hey, the jihadis are the ones who are getting all the guns. I read that as a concession by the establishment that basically this is so true they kind of have to admit it rather than it's an accusation by the Times against the government that, oh, we caught you slipping. And so, in other words, here we are in 2016, and it's very easy to say that, look, never even mind any alternative source, even the New York Times and the Washington Post. According to their history of America's intervention in Syria since 2011, the terrorists got their guns and money from us and our allies. That's just the story. It's completely undeniable. And if it was some birther who made it up, it would be the most crackpot conspiracy crap in the world. But sorry, it's just perfectly true.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You're exactly right.
So let me ask you this, and I know you can't answer because it's a ridiculous question, but what's going on in Hillary Clinton's brain that she's and the rest of these State Department people, that they're willing to continue pursuing this policy, James? I want to play this short clip for you. It's only 10 seconds long here, 12 seconds long. This is Hillary from February 2012, beginning of 2012. And CBS News is asking her, why aren't we doing more to overthrow Assad? And so she's making an excuse why we're not doing more to overthrow Assad.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria?
So now it's a rhetorical question, and there's no need to overinterpret it or anything. She's saying basically, by supporting some rebels, are we helping ones that we don't like, right? That's what she's saying. And she's saying that would be really dangerous. We don't want to do that, right? But then we know the history is she spent the rest of 2012 pushing for exactly that until the end of her term as Secretary of State. And now her position is we should have done more. We should have done more. We should have done more.
Yeah, I think part of it is that she's trying to I think her instincts are naturally very hawkish. I had not heard that clip, and I'm shocked by the good common sense that she showed in it. We're 4 years away from that, and she seems to, she's very much a captive, I think, of the Washington foreign policy establishment's groupthink. Her foreign policy advisors are all uniformly hawkish. She actually, you probably saw the report last week that the leader of the neocons, Robert Kagan, will be speaking at a fundraiser for her very soon. She has very hawkish advisors over at the Center for New American Security. The woman who is thought to be the leading candidate to be her Secretary of Defense, Michelle Flournoy, recently said that she believes the United States ought to be sending troops into Syria. That was reported in Defense One, which is a very, very reliable defense industry publication. She's surrounded herself by hawks because she is basically a hawk herself. And I think that if we get a Hillary Clinton administration, we will be sort of wistfully looking back at the Obama administration for the good sense he's shown. I think that we really are going to see something like a George W. Bush recap or return, a sequel to the George W. Bush administration when she comes in, if the advisors are anything to go by.
Yeah. Well, like you say, Flournoy for Secretary of Defense, probably Kagan's wife, Nuland, for Secretary of State. And, boy, can you just imagine and probably keep Susan Rice and Samantha Power, just all these ladies sitting around drinking tea, agreeing with each other, telling each other how right they are or who they got to kill. It's the world's worst nightmare. I mean, I'm not trying to be too sexist about it, but just these particular women are just, they're, every one of them as wrong as it could be about every stupid thing they think. It's just ridiculous. And the kind of consensus that I could see them forging in their little circle is pretty dangerous. But so now let me ask you something about this, because I was just a kid at the time, and what the hell did I know? I was a high school kid. We talked before, I think, about NATO expansion in Eastern Europe in the 90s and how famously, I hope, George Kennan gave a interview to Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, the most valuable thing he's ever written, that's for sure. And this is in 1998, and this is where George Kennan, who helped really to invent the containment policy against the Soviet Union in the Cold War, said, if we do this, we'll be picking a fight with Russia. And then when they react, all the people doing this will say, see, that's the reason we had to do it, is because of Russian aggression, which is, of course, exactly what has played out. But then here's the reason I'm bringing this up again, is because I just read this new thing. I hope you saw it. I hope everyone in the audience saw it. It was by Jerry Brown, the governor of California, reviewing in the New York Review of Books, reviewing the memoirs of former Secretary of Defense William Perry, who is now on a mission to try to abolish nuclear weapons. But the anecdote here was that There was this letter in 1996, 2 years before that Kennan interview, on the very first round of NATO expansion in 96, that was signed by Robert McNamara and Paul Nitze, who is, my understanding is, he's sort of Kennan, but worse, right? Kennan invented containment. Nitze wanted to roll him back. He was Dr. Strangelove the Hawk. And here's Nitze and McNamara and Richard Pipes, Daniel Pipes' father and Soviet Cold War hawk, saying, don't do this. Don't expand NATO. Do you know that story? Can you explain about what was going on there from the very beginning to have such Cold Warrior hawks who they, correct me if I'm wrong, but these guys didn't all turn into Pat Buchanan peaceniks after the end of the Cold War, but they were definitely not for this kind of expansion, apparently.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I'm glad you mentioned that letter because it seems to have been a bit of forgotten history. Kennan's opposition to NATO is now well known, certainly because of the recent number of biographies and the publication of his diaries and Friedman. Yeah, right. That was you're exactly right. That it's probably the only thing Friedman ever wrote that's worth reading. So this was not the opposition. Simply, it didn't simply come from someone who was a well-known dove and critic of American policy like Kennan. The letter was released in the summer of '97, actually, and you had people on the left or center left, like Senator Bill Bradley, who is now on the board of the American Committee for East West Accord. You had very distinguished scholars like Professor David Kaleo at Hopkins, and you had, as you say, people who were well-known hawks, people on the exact other side of the debate as Kennan, like Nitze and like McNamara. Democratic Senator Sam Nunn, who's a Democrat but a well-known hawk, signed the letter. So there was a wide spectrum of voices on the left, center, and right protesting against this policy. And in his memoirs, the person who drove this policy is someone who is also in the running to be Hillary Clinton's Secretary of State, a gentleman by the name of Stroh Talbot, who's the president of the Brookings Institution today. And he wrote a very valuable memoir of his time as Clinton's he was Deputy Secretary of State, but he was also Clinton's main Russia advisor. So his memoir is called The Russia Hand, and he recounts the debate going on. And these voices were well known to the administration at the time. He recounts going to a dinner, I think it was up at Columbia, where everyone at his table spoke out very forcefully, among them Kennan, against the policy. And he just kind of brushes it off. And Kennan was right. It turned out to be, one of the biggest mistakes of the post-Cold War era.
And it's interesting, too, Talbot is the guy who wrote in 1992 that soon we'll have a one-world government where every nation state answers to the United Nations Security Council on virtually every issue. And then here he is, boy, making sure that didn't happen, which, thank God, but still it not necessarily in a good way. And then isn't he also the guy who last summer, put his name on that report demanding an escalation of the war in Ukraine and that America should send defensive weapons to the Ukrainian army to fight the Russians, to make the body count go up, to make the debate go up. That's a direct quote. To make the debate go up in Russia about whether they want to keep intervening in Ukraine or not. Same guy.
Yes, exactly right. That was a joint report issued by Brookings and the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. And you're right. Talbot's an interesting kind of case study and kind of how a lot of Democrats have evolved or devolved, if you will. During the Reagan administration, he was quite a well-known journalist and critic Republican Cold War policy. He was something of a dove. And then he was friends with Bill Clinton. They went to Oxford together. So they've known each other forever. And Clinton appointed him as his Russia advisor at the State Department. And he and Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and numerous others had transformed into into hawks. And it's been this, and they've been driving policy hand in hand with the neocons ever since. And I think that the results speak for themselves. I think that this policy of arming the Ukrainians is just extraordinarily dangerous and reckless, especially given the character of the Ukrainian regime and the battalions, many of them privately financed by oligarchs, many of them with very sinister Nazi connections. I don't understand why we would want to throw our lot in with people like that. I certainly I have nothing but disdain for people who think that that we should be getting involved, getting in bed with these neo-Nazis and neo-fascists in Ukraine. I think it's disgusting.
Absolutely. I'm sorry we have to stop right here. We could start a whole new interview, but I got to go for the next one. But thank you so much for coming back on the show, James. We'll definitely talk about Ukraine again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks.
All right, y'all. That is James Carden. He is the editor of the website of the American Committee for East-West Accord, which is the most important project on the planet right now, okay? The American Committee for East-West Accord. He writes for The Nation and for Bob Perry's site over there at consortiumnews.com. And that's the Scott Horton Show. Check out the archives at scotthorton.org. Sign up for the podcast feed there. Help support at scotthorton.org/donate. Check out the lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Libertarian audiobooks for any donation of $200 or more there at scotthorton.org/donate. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Thanks, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott here. The thing is, I need you guys to help me to get these download numbers up. So do me a favor and sign up for the podcast feeds of this show. You can choose the whole show or just the interviews at iTunes and Stitcher. All the buttons you need are at the top of the right margin at scotthorton.org. The more subscribers I have, the more iTunes and Stitcher will help promote the show to new listeners. If you're a hardcore fan, brand new or from way back, please leave them customer ratings and reviews, too. Trying to get these wars ended. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism vs. Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism vs. Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.